The 2006 International AIDS Conference, Time to Deliver, brought to you by KaiserNetwork.org. Okay.
Good morning, everyone. I must say it's great to see you here in such good numbers. I think I share your sense, because you're here, that this is an incredibly important issue, and I'm glad that we're able to have such an expert group speaking to it. We've prepared this session well, so I hope it will go well from the panel point of view, and then we need you to dialogue as well. So I think when we have heard from the panel, we'll go straight to the floor. There are microphones, and I'll try and be fair in distributing between the microphones. And I would ask you just to tell us who you are briefly when you put your question or your comment. I've been at quite a number of sessions, as I think you have as well. Not one session that I attended didn't bring up centrally the issue of stigma and discrimination, linked to gender-based violence, linked to very often that it particularly bore on women and on girls, the fact that it's underestimated all the time. One of my hats that I'm proud to wear here at this conference is I'm patron of the International Community of Women Living with AIDS. And I've talked to a lot of my colleagues, and their story begins with the extent of the stigma. And even still, it takes me back. You know, it kind of, it hurts me to think that people get treated the way they get treated, that there are such smears, such innuendos, if not actual physical violence, have been thrown out of the home or whatever. So we really need to address this and to find strategies that work better, because we are not highlighting enough. We're not realizing that it's crucial to prevention, it's crucial to access to treatment, it's crucial to the living together in communities and neighborhoods. And it is deeply an issue that is at the core of a human rights approach. So without further ado, because we have good panelists and I also want to hear from many of you, I'm going to introduce our first speaker. I'll introduce each of the speakers as I call upon them. I'll sit to do the rest of the introductions. But it gives me great pleasure to introduce Dr. Mandeep Dhaliwal. As you know, he works in the International HIV and AIDS Alliance and the Lawyers Collective HIV and AIDS Unit. He's chair of PARA 55, the Commonwealth Action Group on HIV and AIDS, and he's been working on issues of HIV and AIDS and human rights for over 20 years. And I think what he will do is give us an overview. He'll refer to the work that came out of the universal access process, and he will highlight that political will and funding is still needed to address stigma and discrimination. And I would really put an emphasis on the political will. Interestingly, you don't hear leaders speaking about stigma and discrimination so much. You hear it always from those who've suffered it, because it hurts and it imprints on their soul. We don't hear it enough at a political will level how we're going to tackle it. So let's hear Dr. Dhaliwal first, and then I look to you to help us to create the strategies that will make a difference. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's an honor to be here, and I was expecting a bit of conference fatigue today in the audience, but clearly everybody's really interested and here, and I hope we're going to have a very interesting session. I'd like to begin by acknowledging a range of people who've contributed to this presentation with their intellect and their integrity and their commitment, and I hope that the presentation does their contributions justice. Just to share a little bit with you the method of putting together this presentation, I had the privilege of being involved in the Global Steering Committee process that was led by the Department for International Development of the UK Government and UNAIDS on looking at what were some of the barriers and solutions and potentially developing a roadmap to universal access. There were a series of meetings and reports. There were 51 country consultations. And I've reviewed four regional consultation reports, though there were nine regional consultations. The presentation is also based on a civil society consultation that the International HIV/AIDS Alliance led on what were some of the barriers and concerns for civil society around achieving universal access. And also, I've also had a look at the deliberations and the outcomes of the high-level meeting on AIDS. As many of you know, the Global Steering Committee generated a report based on a lot of these consultations, which was submitted to the Secretary General and then influenced the development of the political declaration that came out of the high-level meeting on AIDS. Discussion will also be based on some of the findings and studies and work of the Lawyers Collective HIV/AIDS Unit and some of the discussions that I've been hearing over the last couple of days here at the conference. So, context. It's a particularly exciting time, I think. We have historic commitments to universal access by a range of political leaders. With those historic commitments comes a responsibility and an urgency to translate these international commitments to implementation of sound evidence-based programs which address stigma and discrimination at the country level. Achieving a universal access efficiently and effectively will mean addressing stigma and discrimination. So what were some of the issues that we heard during the country consultations? Almost all of the country consultations and regional consultations described stigma and discrimination, including fear of stigma and discrimination and violence, as key barriers to achieving universal access, and also barriers to currently accessing HIV prevention, treatment, and care. Many studies also indicated that national efforts are not sufficiently prioritizing the delivery of essential life-preserving interventions to those at greatest risk. We know that coverage of prevention services for key populations is less than 20%, and coverage of treatment services is next to nothing for these populations. And I have to say that we've heard a lot of people talk about make comments referring to 25 years into the epidemic, and I am deeply embarrassed and humiliated that 25 years into the epidemic, at UN meetings, people find it difficult to name vulnerable populations, to tell the truth, that those at greatest risk are sex workers, drug users, transgenders, women, girls, and children. If we cannot name these populations, we are not going to make any progress in addressing their needs and delivering universal access. Gender inequality was cited as a major barrier and something which needs to be addressed. According to UNAIDS, almost 82% of countries have policies in place to ensure equal access between men and women to HIV prevention and care. In reality, however, we know it is a very different situation. We know social, legal, and economic factors impede women's access to life-saving services. Availability and accessibility of services was always raised as an issue. We know that there is a great lack of appropriate sexual and reproductive health and HIV services for young people who are at great risk, and also other populations such as sex workers, drug users, men who have sex with men, transgender populations do not have access to sexual and reproductive health and HIV services. Lack of access to free treatment, antiretroviral treatment, is a major impediment to achieving universal access. We heard in this morning's plenary that those people who have access to free ART do much better in terms of adherence. Over half the countries which submitted data to UNAIDS reported the existence of laws and policies that hinder access to HIV prevention, treatment, and care currently for vulnerable populations. These need to be addressed if we're going to achieve universal access. Examples of such laws and policies include the criminalization of consensual sex among adults of the same gender, legal impediments to syringe exchange or substitution therapy. And it was interesting to note in yesterday's press conference that former President Clinton noted his administration's mistake in changing the policy to not fund needle exchange. We can't afford any such mistakes anymore, and these mistakes must be reversed if we're going to achieve universal access. Another example of a law which prevents access to HIV prevention, care, and treatment services is the use of residency status to restrict access to services. I live in the United Kingdom, and I'm embarrassed to say that residency status is used to exclude people from HIV prevention, treatment, and care. Scaling up HIV testing and counseling is something which came up in a little bit in these country consultations, but I think it's been discussed much more at this conference. We know that we need to scale up HIV testing and counseling, but we cannot do it at the expense of human rights protections. We must ensure protections for discrimination, confidentiality, and ensure that treatment and access to treatment is a reality as we're scaling up testing and counseling. There also needs to be some consideration of the fact that not everyone is equally empowered to opt out, particularly in a doctor-patient relationship, which is based fundamentally on inequality. And as my colleague Susie McLean always says, there's always a slippery slope between opt-out testing and mandatory testing. And over 25 years, we have seen many examples of this. So we must be vigilant as we're scaling up HIV testing and counseling, that if we are using opt-out models, they don't turn into mandatory testing. And really what's been clear throughout the last couple of days is that there's a real need for more evidence on how VCT, routine testing, routine offer of testing are being implemented and will be implemented. And not just evidence from the provider perspective. We need evidence from beneficiaries as well. All the Botswana evidence we've heard at this conference has all been provider perspectives. And I would like to say that that is insufficient to really tell us what's happening in communities in terms of the stigma and discrimination related to HIV and AIDS. So what are our commitments? What commitments did 192 member states of the UN commit to? They committed to an intensification of efforts to eliminate all forms of stigma and discrimination. And I think this is particularly challenging given the multi-layered dimension of stigma and discrimination. They also committed to ensuring full access to services with full protection of confidentiality, informed consent, and a supportive social and legal environment, and the elimination of gender inequalities and gender-related abuse and violence. So what do we need to do to deliver on these commitments? As I said before, we need to increase and sustain political and financial commitments at the global level to sustained action at the country level. That's where the epidemic is, in countries. We need to scale up specific interventions to reduce stigma, discrimination, and gender inequity. And this must be, commitment to this must be built and sustained at country level. And we're going to hear from various colleagues on the panel about specific interventions to reduce stigma and discrimination. More generally, we need to promote, protect, and fulfill the human rights of those most vulnerable. We need to provide access to medicines, diagnostics, and condoms. Discussions around universal access cannot be delinked from what happens in the World Trade Organization and discussions around TRIPS. And also something which I think we heard on the first day, but I haven't heard again and is a very serious issue, is the huge condom gap that exists. If we're scaling up access to prevention, treatment, and care, we need to also make sure that we have sufficient condoms so people can have sex more than 3 times a year. We also particularly need to be vigilant of ourselves, the donor community, and civil society, in addressing the changing faces of stigma and discrimination. We need to pay particular attention to the increasing trends in criminalization of transmission of HIV. We know that this contradicts public health objectives. We also need to make sure that we are constantly vigilant of the fact that our investment, our hard-earned money, goes into evidence-based interventions. And I know we focus a lot on the U.S. government as one of the biggest perpetrators of investment in non-evidence-based interventions in terms of funding abstinence-only programs and not funding needle exchange. But I'd also like to bring to your attention the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, who gave a $5 million grant recently to the International Justice Mission. And for those of you who don't know, I encourage you to go look at the website of the International Justice Mission. They rescue victims of the sex trade. We know that this is very much against all the evidence we've seen in terms of how we need to deliver HIV interventions to sex workers. So I would encourage the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation to be a little more vigilant about what they're spending their money on. Concrete solutions. We know what these are, and it was very interesting. I'd like to take a minute here because I've also heard some very disturbing comments about how human rights frameworks and how legal protections and law and policy reform are Western impositions. I'd like to tell you that these 51 country consultations were not all Western countries. Actually, they were all developing countries from Asia, Africa, Latin America, and the Caribbean, and the Eastern Europe. This is what they're telling us are the concrete solutions that they require to achieve universal access. So people who want to rewrite the health and human rights framework and who say that actually if we want to achieve universal access, we should do away with informed consent and confidentiality and not address stigma concretely, are people who want to take shortcuts. And no such shortcuts can be allowed if we want our investments in HIV prevention, treatment, and care to be long-term and sustainable. So these were the concrete solutions proposed by the 51 countries and the 9 regional consultations. They called for reform and repeal of laws and policies which perpetuate stigma, discrimination, and inequalities, laws which impede access to HIV prevention, treatment, and care, with a particular focus on issues of access to medicines, HIV testing, criminalization, and gender inequality. They call for the enactment of anti-discrimination legislation which protects and promotes the rights of people with HIV, accompanied by education of communities and policymakers and real access to legal services, free access to antiretroviral treatment, and an investment in social mobilization on HIV and AIDS, and mobilizing people living with HIV as a crucial part of the response. They also called for real tools to monitor progress, country-level targets for reducing stigma, discrimination, and inequality. So I'd like to leave you with a question and 2 calls. Being a good activist, I always have a call. So the question is, if you were a national AIDS program manager, and as a part of your country's universal access plan, you have to invest in 2 to 3 key stigma reduction interventions, what would you invest in? And my calls are this. Call for national universal access plans. I don't know if many of you know, but one of the key outcomes of this whole political declaration was that every country has to set a national universal access plan by the end of 2006. Do you know whether the plans in your countries are being set? Who is involved in setting them? There needs to be transparency in the setting of these universal access plans. These plans must include specific and significant investment in stigma reduction interventions. And we've heard a lot of very glib statements about putting the power in the hands of women. I would like to call for putting the hands in the power of people to protect themselves in the hands of not just women, but in the hands of those typically marginalized populations in our society that we are afraid to name. Sex workers, men who have sex with men, transgender, drug users, and children. Without these investments and these commitments, universal access will neither be achieved nor will it be sustained. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed, Mandeep. Could I begin with a humble apology? I think I gave you a temporary sex change when I was introducing you. It was the jet lag from coming down those escalators through all those crowds. But there were actually a couple of points you made that I just wanted to reinforce, though you made them wonderfully, about not naming the vulnerable groups. And then you mentioned the condom gap. And I find there's also a gap even in naming the female condom. We do not hear anything about the one practical protection that women can try to influence if they can negotiate. We need to just be more honest about things. What is it about not being able to mention the female condom? So I hope that you posed excellent questions to the floor, which I think is also very good. And frankly, I've just come literally from a press conference of ICW on the opt-out testing. And these are women living at grassroots in developing countries, and they are very worried about the opt-out testing and the routine quick fix. And that's a message that we may hear more of here, but I was very struck by those who are living with the issues, living with stigma, living with discrimination, are very, very worried about the impetus that we're seeing here of somehow that's part of the answer. And testing doesn't mean access to treatment. There are very different things. It may be a gateway to stigma, in fact. Anyway, I mustn't be making speeches. I must be a good chair. And the next person I have the pleasure of introducing is Dr. Laura Nyblade, who is the public health demographer at the International Center for the Research on Women, ICRW. She's worked extensively on the issue of HIV-related stigma through several studies that examined both the factors that perpetuate or mitigate stigma and how those factors affect access to HIV prevention, care, and support. Laura has also led work to develop, test, and validate indicators for measuring HIV stigma and supported the development of practical anti-stigma tools. She's currently leading work to further develop stigma indicators and evaluate stigma reduction interventions in Tanzania and Vietnam. She holds a PhD in demography from the University of Pennsylvania. Laura, it's a pleasure to introduce you.
Thank you. Thank you. Before I begin, I'd like to start with a quote from Canon Gideon Yamgisha from Anarela, which is the African network of religious leaders living with or personally affected by HIV and AIDS. He says, "Everyone is now mobilized around universal access, which is great. But no one is talking about the fact that to reach this goal, we need to eliminate stigma, shame, denial, discrimination, inaction, and misaction before 2010. So I'm here to follow the great set up by Mandeep to talk a little bit about the action part of this. And I'm here to say that we have no more excuses for inaction. We know enough, we have interventions, we have tools, and those excuses have gone away for not doing something about stigma and discrimination. So what do we know at this point about HIV-related stigma? As Mandeep has already explained, it's a barrier to universal access. We also know it's universal across the globe. It is experienced everywhere. We also know it's very prevalent, and I'm going to show some data to illustrate this in a minute. We also know it's differentially experienced by women and men. Everyone experiences high levels of stigma and discrimination, but it's experienced differentially. We also know it's actionable, and two of the other panelists will talk about specific interventions to do that. And we also know now that it's measurable. Therefore, we can measure whether our stigma reduction interventions are having an effect, which has been an excuse or a barrier to not funding programs to reduce stigma, because we cannot measure it. We no longer have that excuse. I'm going to, there's lots of work out there that's on stigma. I'm just going to illustrate some of these points from ICRW and partners' six-year program on research to action around stigma. This is work that's been focused in four countries initially: Ethiopia, Tanzania, Zambia, and Vietnam. From that preliminary or initial research, we then brought that research back to communities and developed and then adapted stigma reduction tools. I'll talk a little bit about that also. And we've also been working on the issue of measuring stigma, including field testing indicators for validity and reliability, which another colleague on the panel is going to talk more about. And we are in the process of evaluating stigma reduction interventions. We are at the point where we can have action. This is from our study in Tanzania, and this is a survey of people living with HIV and AIDS. And this is just to show you that it is prevalent. And you can see it is also, it's prevalent for everyone, but it's experienced more by women than men in this sample. And so that's just to make the point. I'd like to say that from our qualitative work, which was based in four countries, and we had over 700 interviews that went into that analysis, that although there are some notable variations in stigma that stem from differences in language, culture, and epidemic history, these differences are largely of nuance and degree rather than substance. Instead, we find commonalities across all settings in what causes stigma, the forms in which stigma is expressed, and the consequences of stigma. Stigma is common at its core. It is in all of us. And this has also, I think, been an excuse for inaction. It's too culture specific. It would cost too much to actually do something about stigma because it's different everywhere. It's not. It's common at its core. Again, I just want to talk a little bit about the differential experience that we measured between men and women. Women and men are experiencing stigma at high levels, but women are experiencing the more severe forms in greater percentages. We have to address violence if we are going to reduce stigma. We need to look at these issues together. And as you can see here, women are much more likely to experience assault, abandonment by spouse or family, to be threatened with violence, or to have their property taken away. So that we need to, in our response, also recognize these differences and start addressing them. I'd also just like to say that some of the underlying causes that we see for HIV-related stigma and discrimination remain high. In the survey in Tanzania, around 47% of survey respondents in a community-based random sample expressed fear of HIV infection through casual contact. We measured 12 different items there. That leads directly to isolation, physical isolation that is experienced. We also know that stigmatizing attitudes remain high. 50% of our sample agreed with one of three shame items. For example, I would feel ashamed if someone in my family had HIV or AIDS. 66% agreed with one of four judgment and blame items. For example, HIV/AIDS is a punishment for bad behavior. So you see some of the underlying issues that are driving stigma remain high and need to be addressed. Now I'd like to turn to say we can have action. Anti-stigma tools and intervention models exist, and I'm just going to talk briefly about these. I don't have a lot of time. There is a toolkit that was developed through participatory materials development workshops in three countries in Africa that has been widely used effectively. It's been adapted to many contexts. It's out there. It's available. It's there for people to use, and people are using it with lots of success. We have tools. There are also other tools out there. For example, for healthcare workers, there's a toolkit that Engender Health has put together. Horizons has some materials around that. We have tools to start helping us respond. This particular toolkit is available in multiple languages and is an ongoing process in improvement. There's actually a second edition in process that the International HIV/AIDS Alliance is leading out of a regional initiative in East and Southern Africa. We also know that there are practical interventions that are being implemented in multiple settings, some using this toolkit and with different groups. So these, we can have interventions with multiple groups. I'd also like to say on this past Saturday, we had a one-day consultation on the issue of stigma discrimination and heard from three different intervention programs that have been ongoing, one from Vietnam, which the Institute for Social Development Studies is leading, one from Tanzania, Kimbara Peer Educations and Promoter Trusts were leading, and one from Mexico, and we heard from Juan Hernandez from Colectivo Sol. And I wanted to just share with you a few of the key take-home messages that they presented from their experience in actually implementing stigma reduction programs. The first is that you need to start at home. Just because you think you've been working on HIV for years, that you don't need to do anything first within your own organizations or your own institutions. The message was start at home, recognize what stigma and discrimination is. Oftentimes we don't realize, for example, when we gossip, that that is a form of stigma that can be extremely damaging. You need to build skills to address stigma, and you need to listen, let go, and learn from the groups that Mandeep has mentioned, men who have sex with men, commercial sex workers, vulnerable women who are experiencing violence, children, and transgendered people. We need to listen, let go, and learn if we're going to have effective stigma reduction interventions. The second is open the gate and build capacity among leaders. In particular, we heard from our colleagues in Vietnam how effective opening the gate at the top levels of government has been. Work with policymakers, community, and religious leaders. The other lessons were that you have to involve groups experiencing stigma. People living with HIV or AIDS, men who have sex with men, sex workers, transgendered people, injecting drug users, and carers. You need to enhance the visibility and raise awareness of stigma among these groups first, and then and work on addressing self-stigma, and then build skills for advocacy, the defense of human rights, and the education of others. The other lesson was how powerful networking between stigmatized populations for joint solidarity can be. All of these groups found that you have to target the media, police, and healthcare workers. You need to have a participatory approach. Two of these have used the toolkit with great success. You need diversified activities, and you need to use positive images of people living with HIV and AIDS. And a key message that came out from all of the groups, and which is a real challenge, is that you need sustained activities over time. You need to incorporate stigma reduction into all existing activities. For example, the program in Tanzania has incorporated it into home-based care activities, peer education, counseling, and a number of other activities that makes it more sustainable over time. And that you need to provide ongoing support and refresher training for those who are implementing these interventions. So we'll wrap up now. I was asked to talk about remaining gaps and next steps in both research and programs. We need studies that examine the relationship between what happens when you really reduce stigma to the uptake of HIV services, treatment, and prevention, to universal access to all of these things. We also have been hearing that perhaps all you need to do is provide ART and stigma will go away. We need studies that look at this in a rigorous manner. I think all of those who work on the ground will probably say that this is not the case, but this is what we're hearing. Again, an excuse for not funding stigma reduction interventions. Just provide treatment and stigma will go away. We know that that is not the case. We need studies that document that in a rigorous way that we can use for evidence-based advocacy. We need to look at the nexus between gender, stigma, and violence. We cannot address each of these individually. They are interlinked. We need more understanding of how the linking happens and how to have programming that addresses these three things together. We need to look at layered stigma. The groups that are experiencing stigma the most are groups that are already experiencing stigma before HIV, and now you add HIV stigma and more violence on top of it. We need to understand more about that. And we need operations research to rigorously evaluate stigma reduction programs so that we can show that that programs are effective and learn what are the best ways to move forward with this. We need to have a standardized set of stigma indicators that works across the globe. I think there has been initial work that shows that this is possible, and Charles will talk more about one of those efforts. But I hear again and again, particularly from the policymakers and the donors, if you can't measure it, we can't fund it. We can measure it now. We know that. So that excuse is no longer there. We need to find a forum for sharing best practices and collective learning. At this conference, I've heard of numerous programs around the globe that are working to reduce stigma, but we don't have a very good forum for sharing that knowledge and learning from each other. We need to adapt those successful tools and practices so that we can scale up. And we need increased advocacy for the issue of stigma and discrimination, particularly at the leadership level in governments and on the international stage. Just to end, I want to say it can be reduced. We have no more excuses for not addressing stigma. We understand enough to act. We have practical tools that we can use. We have measures to evaluate our progress. And each of us sitting here can make a difference. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Laura, for that very practical contribution to the issues of how to address stigma. The fact that we now have toolkits, we have ways to measure, we have steps that need to be taken that all of us can contribute to. And I'd like to link that with the call that Mandeep made for attention to the fact that there need to be national universal access plans by the end of this year, because they need to include the ways of measuring the toolkits, the addressing, and so all of that, I think, gives us the beginnings of the kind of strategy that has to emerge from this session if we're really going to help to advance. And I liked your last point, Laura, about learning from each other and learning across, and I'm very pleased to see that in this session, at least, we are being very open about vulnerable groups and repeating them in a way that I think is right. I now would like to call on Anvar Luna. He's the project coordinator of the Mexican Network of People Living with HIV and AIDS. He's been living with the virus since 1991, and he's an access to treatment activist. and he's also a consultant on stigma and discrimination for USAID policy project, Costella Futures. You have the floor.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you for this opportunity to talk in this conference. I want to start my presentation sharing with you some consequences of the internal stigma. I will focus on internal stigma, or as Laura said, self-stigma. Although I have accepted the virus myself, the thing is I don't want anyone next to me. It is a kind of lie, not telling the truth, like if they don't ask him, I don't tell. If I said that I got HIV, they could fire me, and then many possibilities in my life will be over. When I learned that I had HIV, I cut myself off from the world because I felt bad about myself. I locked myself in the house and I didn't answer the phone all the day I slept. This is some examples of how internal stigma affect the life of the people. But I want to go to the issue. So what understood about internal stigma? So internal stigma refers to the self-perceived stigma or the internal manifestation of accepted stigma or negative social perceptions transformed into such things such as fear and anxiety or hurt. In order to understand that, we try to develop, or we develop that as schema in order to put clear those ideas. So we understood that internal stigma is that shame that it's associated with the HIV and AIDS and the fear of being discriminated against. So we understood that this phenomenon has three key issues. The experience of the context, which refers to the environment, the self-perception, which refers to how the people perceive the context, and the protective action. The protective action is how the people try to defend themselves against the context. I'm going to be through each one of these issues. The experience of the context. The experience of the context, it focuses on physical and environmental situations, several interacting elements that lead to an overall sense of loss of control. Some key elements include denigration and negative prejudice, misinformation, economical and social pressures, and physical deterioration such as lipodystrophia. And it's like in a Mexican society where it is very common that homosexuality is a very bad behavior. So if the rest of the population perceive the homosexuality as a bad thing, that create an environment that affect this perception of the self stigma. And I'm going to go through the self-perception, which includes to recurring to deep stated feelings of shame, guilt, fear, to being discovered, for dying or infecting others, blame and anguish. And I will come back to this example of the homosexuality in the society. If the rest of the society think that homosexuality is something that it's dirty, is something that I had to feel guilt, I will assume that the society is right, and I will felt guilt, and I will feel dirty. So the next component of this process is the protective action. And for me, in order to link this with the access, is the key issue. The protective action includes avoidance and self-exclusion, avoiding long-term plans, such as buy a house, asking for a job, asking for a scholarship for a school, avoiding activities in general, including, for example, seeking health services, and I'm going through this example more specifically, more in detail, isolation and safe withdrawal, keeping to oneself and avoiding social activities, avoiding intimate intercourse. And this is very, very important. During the work that we carry out in Mexico, we found that many, many people express that when they discover that they are HIV positive, they decide to stop to intimate life. They decide to don't fall in love again, for example. They said, I don't want to know anything about love because my sentimental life now is over. And for us, this was a very key issue about this protective action. They want to protect their feelings. Subterfuge and denial, hiding or misleading others as to sex status or sexual orientation. For example, this situation that I told you about, the homosexuality in Mexico. So what is the impact of the internal stigma in the context of the access? Well, one example is the fear to be texting. People don't want to be tested because they know the bad consequences of the stigma and discrimination. They want to be refused by family, for friends, or the partners. Fear to being seen in HIV-related facilities or receiving HIV services. Many times the people receive a HIV positive result and they don't want to go to the hospital because they don't want that anyone see them around the hospital or on the line to receive medicines, on the line to go to that clinic that they know that it's the doctor that provides services to people living with HIV. Loss of adherence to treatment. The people didn't want to take pills in the social environment. They just hide the pills and they don't want to go to any party or other social events because they just be afraid of that. The loss of the opportunity to receive adequate treatment, no matter if it is available in Mexico. Now we have more access to treatments, but we realize that the stigma and discrimination now is a barrier to the access because many people don't want to go to the health facilities, again, for the fear to be linked with HIV. Fear to the side effects in very, very specific, like polydysmorphia. The people don't want to suffer the side effects because they know that if they look a little tired, the people will realize that he or she is HIV positive and they just don't want to take the pills because that fear. Shame to talk with the health service providers on sexual issues. And this is very, very bad issue because many people just don't talk about this and they wait until the sexual transmitted disease is so, so bad to receive urgent attention. And this is a great barrier in order to improve the quality of life of the people. Fair to discuss to reproductive issues with health service providers. Yesterday, I was in a table where my colleagues discussed widely that issue about how some health providers just deny the right of the women and men to have that reproductive rights. So we identify some strategies to reduce internal stigma. One of them is enhancing the capacity building and social capital and personal development. Build capacities in areas related to the personal and social growth. Increasing self-esteem and sense of self-worth. Improving individual social capital, environment and social organizations and groups, sense of influence and social spheres, and sense of social integrated or trust in social institutions and authorities. We think that it's very important to help them, to help people to feel more integrated, to create more supportive environments in order that people can reintegrate themselves into their society. Improving support services for persons living with HIV, ensuring quality of the care and comprehensive care and support, developing economic independence, and maintaining confidentiality in workplace, health settings, and various social spheres. We are working more specifically in health facilities because we identified that most of the important fears that people are suffering are related with health facilities. So we think we have to stress that kind of strategies. The number three is increasing visibility of persons living with HIV as productive members of the society, providing more positive models, building leadership skills, strengthening self-support groups and social networks. We think that this is a very important issue in order to create more supportive environments. But if, for example, media is still providing to the rest of the society a very bad image of people living with HIV, this work just can't do it. So we think that we have to create positive models to encourage people to give the face, but help them to consider pros and cons to give the face and try to provide safe environments to do that. So where to from here? We think we have to strengthen capacity building of people living with HIV networks, but not only formal networks, also informal networks, such as family, friends, partners. Internal stigma and strengthening support groups of social support networks, again, and training and sensibilization of health professionals, and baseline to measuring internal stigma. This is a great challenge because this is a very complex issue, and we need to develop specific indicators that can help us to measure that complexity of that elements involved in that phenomenon. Develop and implement stigma and mitigation and pre-stigmatization communities such as sex workers, such as men who have sex with men, women, and young people. So, as I show you in this vicious circle, I invite you to put these three issues into a vicious cycle. We think internal stigma represents an obstacle for HIV visibility. The lack of HIV visibility in the society or in the community is an obstacle for access. The lack of access reinforces all the elements linked with the stigma. So we have to break down that vicious circle in order to improve the environment. And I would like to finish my presentation with a positive voice that shows how if we come to deal with this internal stigma, we can create leaders that can contribute in the response of the HIV epidemic. I am like another person, being seropositive, does not stop or limit to me, but on the contrary, it motivates to me. This is my friend Juan, and this is the thing that I want to show you. And I want to acknowledge all that people that helped us in this presentation with their photos, showing how the visibility contributes to create better environments, and how the voices of the people living with HIV also creates to helps to create a better understanding about the stigma and discrimination. And also I want to acknowledge to my colleagues and to my friend Ken Morrison, who helped me to prepare this presentation. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Anwar, for that excellent presentation. As I listen to you talk so eloquently about the internal stigma, the self-stigma, it made me think again about the link between stigma and discrimination and human rights, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And I was thinking, if we reflect back to Article 1, which says, all human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights. And actually, dignity comes before rights. And it's the undermining of that self-worth, self-dignity, that is at the heart of the core of why stigma is so eroding and so difficult and so... And you made a very good point, I think, towards the end that we must bear in mind later. Increasing the visibility of persons living with HIV as productive members of society. Now, I relate very much to that because a lot of the positive women in particular in ICW, positive in local communities that I meet, I've learned so much from, and they are extremely productive, but they don't often get enough visibility and enough space and airtime. And it now gives me great pleasure to introduce Dr. Glenda Gray, who will give a clinician's perspective, including PMPCT. She's a pediatrician from RSA, a director of the Perinatal HIV Research Unit, and she has been awarded a number of awards, including the Nelson Mandela Health and Human Rights Award for her work in PMPCT. And she also worked in Soweto in the 90s, demonstrating that women and children in poor settings could take ARVs meticulously. So, and also you've come across lots of discrimination issues, so you have the floor.
Thanks. I'm just trying to find the forward pointer. Is it over here? Oh, yeah, sorry, I didn't see it, sorry. I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me to this important session. And I'm going to present data from healthcare workers after 2000, so we could look at what is happening in places in the developing world where heart access was available. And also while walking around the conference and attending sessions, it seems to me that the issues that we see in London are the same as in Lagos, and that a discrimination in the healthcare setting is pervasive in all settings. I just wanted to again underline the importance of what stigma is, and it's a complex social phenomenon which changes, which results in a powerful and discriminating social label that changes the way people view themselves, which is experienced as self-stigma or internal stigma, or externally, which is seen as discrimination. And internal stigma is very important because it can actually lead to a person's unwillingness to seek help or access resources. And external stigma in the form of discrimination actually can lead to one's perceived or actual HIV status being discriminated against in a healthcare setting. So I'm going to ask four questions. I'm going to pose four questions in this presentation. And one is to ask the question, are there discriminatory practices in the healthcare setting?
What contributes to this? You know, how do we get into healthcare workers' heads to try and understand why they discriminate in the healthcare setting? How their impact on access to care, and can healthcare workers change their attitudes? I'll start off with a study done in India, which is a study done in about 4 hospitals in India that showed that nearly 2/3 of all staff fell into the moderate stigma category, and almost 1/4 fell into the high stigma category. Doctors displayed similar stigma profiles as to other healthcare workers, be they nurses or counselors. And as posted yesterday from London, Alfred and colleagues also reported that almost 50% of HIV-infected people who they had studied had reported discrimination by a healthcare worker, and dentists and GPs were named as the top people who discriminated against them in that setting. It's important to try and understand why healthcare workers are discriminating in the healthcare setting. Here you can see that where staff believe that HIV can be transmitted by casual contact, they have much higher stigma scores than those who do not have. If you have a look at the data from hepatitis C, the people who knew how hepatitis C was transmitted would have low stigma scores. Staff also scored very high on the stigma index the staff that scored very high on the stigma index were more likely to report discriminatory practices. You can see that people who had high stigma avoided going near people who were HIV infected or touching HIV positive patients. A recent study that has just been published in PLOS from Nigeria looked at the healthcare practices towards patients, and this is a very recent study. And you can see that in people sampled, almost 10% had refused to care for a patient with HIV/AIDS, and 10% had refused hospital admission. What's also very concerning is that other healthcare workers had observed other healthcare workers refusing treatment and refusing admission, and 66% had observed the refusing of care, and around 43% had refused the access to hospital admission. And this data is very important because it raises the possibility that patients with HIV/AIDS may not fully utilize healthcare services because they are denied access. And that is the one thing we need to address. Looking at another list of studies and trying to understand why healthcare workers are discriminatory, you can see that there's a direct relationship between knowledge regarding how HIV is transmitted, the adherence or availability of universal precautions, and the perception of HIV acquisition via occupational exposure. And if you overestimate your occupational exposure, risk of occupational exposure, or you have poor availability of universal precautions, or you don't adhere properly to them, you will have stigmatizing attitudes and behavior. From quarantine, from people in Madagascar in a PMTT setting, saying that HIV-infected people should be quarantined, to having reservations of treating HIV-infected people and viewing them with fear. And the worst part of this study for me was that doctors were as bad as other healthcare workers in their discriminatory practices. We also see, because of discrimination, people use universal precautions in inappropriate fashions. And these are just quotes from people, some qualitative data, showing that in some settings, nurses will wear double gloves, they will wear a mask when they change a linen, they'll keep the sheet separate, they'll burn the linen, and they'll even throw away the utensils of people living with HIV and AIDS. Looking at how healthcare workers' perception impact on ARV access in PMTCT settings, two studies, one from Zambia and one from Vietnam, show that 84% of healthcare workers in Zambia believe that the diagnosis of HIV was associated with negative images such as prostitution and marital infidelity. 47% of them said they personally felt that HIV was something to be ashamed of. And what's very scary in this study was that 60% of healthcare workers had chosen not to be tested. They would rather not know if they were HIV infected. So in Vietnam, similarly, healthcare women who were HIV infected who were trying to access care in antenatal settings said that HIV-related stigma was a major hurdle for them to access care. And in this setting, non-medical staff were identified as perpetrators of discrimination. So as you can see, even in Zambia, it seems that healthcare workers are influenced by the discrimination that's seen in communities, and that their perception and education may represent a significant barrier to help people access heart. If you look at further attitudes of healthcare workers, you can see the issues of the layers of stigma that we've seen. If you're HIV infected, you're poor, have extramarital affairs, you're drug users, and you're sex workers. A person living with HIV is refused treatment. People say they don't have beds, they don't examine people, they don't examine patients, they forget to do their dressings, and they don't give them medication. So seeing this, you can see the different layers of HIV, of stigma, different layers that people experience. So how does this all affect treatment? And I think that's a very important issue. And you can see that HIV-positive persons may not seek treatment or delay going to doctors due to a real or perceived discrimination against them. And looking at a survey done in the U.S., 36% reported experiencing discrimination by a healthcare worker, including 8% who had been refused medical services. Those who had experienced stigma were also more likely to miss an HIV clinic appointment, lapse in their adherence, and miss their appointment and lapse their adherence. There's also been actual denial of care that has also occurred. In a study done in Botswana, which has been recently published, it seems that access to heart has appeared to reduce stigma in Botswana. So here we have an example that at a community level, with introduction of heart, possibly we can start seeing reductions in stigma. Looking at some work done in Toronto, and I just want to show you the issues around layers of stigma and the perception that there are good ways of getting HIV and bad ways of getting HIV. And to say, this is a quote from Anne Silversides, who was told the story, why didn't you tell us you're a hemophiliac? A nurse in downtown Toronto teaching hospital asked activist James Krepner when he was in hospital with an age-related illness in the 1990s. We would have treated you much better. This is one of the most important slides that I'm going to show you, and it shows you the layers of stigma and access to heart. There's an estimated 36,000 intravenous drug users who were receiving heart by the end of 2004. And of these 36,000, 50,000 lived in Brazil. In Eastern Europe and Central Asia, 70% of HIV cases are attributed to intravenous drug use. And this slide shows the abysmal lack of access of intravenous drug users to treatment. So what contributes to discrimination? And I think a theme that's coming out of this conference is the low morale and lack of resources in healthcare settings. And there was a study presented yesterday from South Africa, and there was a quote from a nurse that said, "If I had wanted to be an undertaker, I wouldn't have trained as a nurse." There's also a lack of understanding how HIV is transmitted in the healthcare setting. We overestimate our risks. We don't have access to good universal precautions. We're not supported with good HIV/AIDS policies and training programs. And the lack of access to materials to augment universal precautions and to protect healthcare workers against occupational exposure seems to be a major factor to discrimination. So the important question is, can healthcare workers change their attitudes? Can you teach an old dog new tricks? And I think we've seen from the previous speakers that there are instruments that can look at and measure stigma, and also there are interventions that you can put in place that will help healthcare workers address the issues of stigma. And these are the results from a study in India that showed that after an intervention, doctors and healthcare workers were more likely to seek informed consent before voluntary counseling and testing, to always seek informed consent, to arrange pre- and post-test counseling, to use gloves to draw blood in people whose status they did not know, and improve access to post-exposure prophylaxis. So in conclusion, stigma and discrimination can impact on effective prevention, care, and support and mitigation of HIV/AIDS. People living with HIV/AIDS have identified stigma and discrimination amongst healthcare workers in VCT and STI facilities as a major deterrent to use these services. Healthcare workers appear to play a role in exacerbating stigma and discrimination. With support and training, healthcare workers can position themselves as true partners to improve the healthcare environment for people living with HIV/AIDS. And I'm going to end with a quote from Nelson Mandela, and to talk about dignity and decency. And it's an elemental matter of human decency, and history will judge us where decency was wanting. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Glenda. I think you've brought another important piece to what we need to consider in looking at strategies to combat stigma and discrimination. The prevalence of stigma in doctors and healthcare workers, and that we can do things about it. And so we have to build that also into the universal access plans. It's another component. And I'm very glad to say that our final speaker, Dr. Charles Katende, is in fact a particular expert on monitoring and evaluation, on measuring stigma. He has a PhD from the University of Pennsylvania. He's worked on stigma and issues for programs of USAID and in supporting their HIV and AIDS planning, programming, and he has contributed to the development of indicators for stigma and strengthening of measuring and evaluating systems. And he sits on the UNAIDS monitoring and evaluation reference group. I haven't tried to curtail any of our speakers because I think the content of their PowerPoint presentations have been so good. And I'm not going to curtail Charles. I hope he won't abuse this. But we will have at least a half an hour, I hope, or near a half an hour afterwards. And I want you to be thinking about your questions, your comments, because I think this has really been a very expert panel and that we have learned a lot already. So over to you, Charles, to be disciplined, because I'm not going to discipline you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure to be presenting to you this experience on field testing stigma measurement tools. We have heard about the various speakers have talked about the stigmas, how it is happening in different populations, in health service providers, in the general populations. And now one of the challenges that remains is how do we measure stigma? Stigma needs to be measured because stigma is an evil that we need to track and know where it is so that we can address it with the appropriate strategies. We also know that we need to measure stigma because, as you know, the donors would like us to be able to measure progress on stigma reduction programs before they can give us the funding. So it is very important to come up with some measures that can help us measure stigma reduction and measure progress of stigma reduction programs. Unfortunately, stigma is a complex phenomenon. It occurs in different populations. It manifests in different ways. And even when you focus on a particular population, it's difficult to measure it because stigmatizing acts cannot easily be recorded and measured. Even when you ask people to report them, people will not likely self-report if they're stigmatized. So it is a complex phenomenon, and we need to find some ways of how to go about it to actually get a handle on measuring it. In this regard, some progress has been made on how to measure stigma. In this progress includes, for example, a stigma framework has been developed. As you know, in program monitoring, a framework is a basic tool that you need for you to be able to do any indicator development and measurement. So I'm glad to report that at least there's an emerging framework that we can use to measure stigma. And using that framework, stigma indicators have been developed and actually field tested. And of course, from the field testing, we now have some of these tools that are available for people to use to measure stigma in their own programs. And let me say up front that we still need further field testing because the field testing needs to be done in different contexts at different sites, so the struggle continues. Now, let me talk about the framework that is emerging. And this is my representation of the framework that has been used to field test stigma indicators. This framework shows basically events as in their causal ordering in terms of background, the underlying factors to stigma, the enacted stigma itself, and the manifestations that is the results of the stigma. The underlying factors are actually some of the elements that programs focus on when they want to implement stigma reduction programs. They focus on the knowledge and fear, and they focus on the value-based stigmas, which are basically feeling ashamed, judgment, blaming. And then also there's the legal reforms and policy frameworks. Then the enacted stigma, of course, is the actual stigma itself, gossiping, avoiding, discriminating, isolating, and so forth. And then the result of this is the self-isolation, disclosure, and decline to use services, and this is what actually fuels some of the epidemics and prevents our progress on universal access. In terms of measuring, you would want to directly measure the enacted stigma, okay, because this is the gist of the matter. However, as I said before, it's difficult to measure this enacted stigma because the stigmatizing acts are not there for you to measure them. You need, they are kind of hidden. So you need to also to look somewhere else. But also remember that programs mostly focus on the underlying factors. So that means that for measuring, we need some indicators at the level of the underlying factors, because programs will need to measure these to show the progress of their stigma reduction programs before they can claim they actually reduced stigma. Of course, there is also the manifestation level where we want to measure stigma using the disclosure, decline to use services, but this is now as a proxy because you assume that if, for example, disclosure increases, then you assume somehow the stigma must have reduced and probably claim that the program was successful. Now, let me share with you some of the experiences that have used this framework to develop indicators. The first experience is the field testing of indicators in Tanzania. And my colleague Laura has mentioned about this. This was an effort to basically improve what was called the existing indicators. You know, we used to use indicators like, would you buy food from an infected person? Would you let a teacher teach? And these are the kind of existing indicators that we tried to look at and thought that they were not good enough. And we went to try to make improvement on these indicators. The purpose also was to field test indicators focusing specifically on the dimensions that I have shown in the framework. The field testing was based on three populations, a community, which is like a general population, the healthcare providers, and people living with HIV/AIDS. These were basically surveys in these populations. Let me now present some of the results from this. I begin with the fear dimension. The idea here was to field test an indicator that would say the percentage of people that have fear of casual contact. People have a lot of fears of casual contact with people living with HIV/AIDS, ranging from fearing the saliva, even a child playing with another child, sharing utensils, caring for an infected person, sleeping in the same room, sitting next to a person who is infected. Sometimes they even fear talking to a person who is infected. So all these fears now have to be measured in order for you to capture to what extent there is fear, because it is that fear that leads to the stigmatization. The results show that of all these fears, you know, these are the different results for the different fears, and overall 46.6 had a fear of one of these. And the analysis, the indicator development analysis showed that you could actually develop an indicator that uses only about five of these items, that those five items would actually capture all the fear that is actually reflected using all the items. So in terms of developing indicators, the recommendation was you need to get items that actually mention the fear, because that is the improvement from the previous indicators. Here we say, do you fear X, Y, Z? And then you need to measure several of these items, and from these items, you can get at least five that will be sufficient to capture the level of fear prevailing in a community. The next one was about the value-based stigma, which has like a feeling ashamed, blaming, and judging. Again, we field tested several stigmatizing attitudes, and the results actually showed that to develop indicators using this kind of statements, you need actually to develop two indicators. One indicator focuses on items that focus on shame, and another indicator focuses on items that focus on blame and judgment. So there were two indicators. But also what was interesting on these stigmatizing attitudes was that when we asked people if they individually accepted, you can see the results, for example, for accepting that the HIV is a punishment was about 39%. But we asked them, do you think people in this community actually would accept this statement? A lot of them said, yes, I think, like 62%. So this was a very interesting finding, but we haven't explored more of that. But the idea was that the indicator here was the two indicators, one on shame and one on blame and judgment. And each of these indicators requires at least three items to measure it properly. We measured other dimensions, experiencing stigma, and these were many items. The key thing to notice here is the difference between male and female. And from this, the indicator we recommended is that an indicator that uses at least one item from the different forms. All these items belong to about four forms of stigma, basically institutional, loss of respect, isolation, and verbal. And the recommendation was that the indicator should include at least one item from each form. These are the conclusions which I've basically mentioned, and I will not repeat that since I'm out of time. Maybe to mention that when we measured the enacted stigma, we found that it best works for the population of people living with HIV/AIDS and not so well with the general community. The full report for this field testing is available on ICRWCDs and on a site and on synergyaids.com. Briefly, let me talk about another effort of field testing indicators, and that is the PHLA index. The PHLA index is being developed basically to focus on the people living with HIV/AIDS. This is based on seven stigma dimensions, and it has an approach which emphasizes using the people living with HIV/AIDS, like they will be the interviewers, and they will be interviewing the people living with HIV/AIDS. It also provides an opportunity for people living with HIV/AIDS to actually self-calculate an index, and that empowers them, because if they know how much stigma they have, then they can take some actions. The field testing for this will be done this year. And of course, the people leading this are the UNAIDS, ICW, IPPF, and GNP. I mentioned that, so I'm out of time. These are the dimensions that will be measured using that effort: the direct experience of stigma and discrimination, the internal stigma, laws and policies, proactivism to confront stigma, disclosure and confidentiality, quality of care, and fear of stigma and discrimination. I want to conclude by saying the progress we have made in measuring stigma indicators is that we have a framework, and the framework has been used to field test indicators, and indicators are actually now available on the resources I've mentioned. So programs can actually go to those resources and adopt some of those tools to measure stigma and discrimination in their own programs. It is important to remember that the indicators are recommended for specific populations, and they are recommended for specific dimensions, and whereby in each dimension you have several items that measure the stigma. The dimension-specific approach enables programs to focus on specific items, because programs may be focusing on fear, so they will have an indicator to measure fear. If they focus on value-based, they will have an indicator to focus on value-based, and so on and so forth. Also, it is important to disaggregate by gender, as we have seen. There's a big difference, a gender difference in the stigma discrimination. And also say that there are concrete now tools available, so feel free to visit those sites. And I think we have also CDs here. I think Rhoda, my colleague here from ICRW, has those CDs. Some people can access them. But those CDs have the tools that you can use. But lastly, we still need to field test, because you know the field tests we have done have been in a few sites, and we still need more sites, but we are on the way, and there's hope. We have the indicators in place. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Charles. I'm really sorry I had to cut you slightly short, having said I wouldn't, but I got bad news, which is that we have to finish by 12:15. So I see that people are already moving to the mics, and I would actually urge anyone who wants to contribute to move to one of the mics. I'm going to start with the middle mic, mic two, because there seems to be a crowd gathered there. And I'm going to take as many questions as possible, leave less time for answers, because actually your points, your questions, are important for all of us to hear. So start with two, and then I'll move to three. And is there anybody on one? Yes, and one. Okay, the whole line in the one there. So I'll start with two, three, and then one. Yeah. Okay.
Okay, two going first. Hi, my name is Nadine France from Health and Development Networks based in Thailand. I have two questions. One for Mandeep. And that is, we heard today, and we know well, that the worst forms of stigma are experienced in the health setting, also informed from research by Shalini Barrett, which I'm sure most people are familiar with. Could I ask Mandeep for you to describe the PWA-friendly checklist that's based on the baby-friendly model just a little bit so that people know a little bit about that, and also if you know something about plans to scale that up, what they are. My second is more a comment with a question on the end. Recently in Thailand, we had a very well-known accident, a well-known activist and very, very good friend who passed away. She passed away and the circumstances of her death were not clear. She was refused an autopsy because she was HIV positive. It was clear and it was on the autopsy. This is in a place in Thailand which is often cited as a place where stigma and discrimination are quite low. What can we do about that? We're devastated. Her family is devastated. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Mike, three.
I'm Rabia Mathai, representing a faith-based organization. I just wanted to draw the attention of this group to the fact that in any developing country, and in most developing countries, 40 to 50% of the healthcare is given by faith-based organizations. And faith-based organizations are very important gatekeepers of communities. They can either make the trust of the communities or break the trust. And I think to shake this giant and tap their resources is very important. Unfortunately, in many cases, the churches are the ones that promote stigma and discrimination. We have to systematically work with them in many communities. Thank you very much.
Very good point. Microphone one.
Thank you. My name is Susie McLean. I'm from the International HIV/AIDS Alliance. And I wanted to raise a question or a concern, really, that when we talk about the root causes of stigma, I was surprised that there wasn't more discussion about homophobia, misogyny, stigmatizing attitudes towards drug use as many of the root causes, not the only root causes, but many of the root causes of stigma. And I accept that fear of virus is an important driver of stigma, but I also think, well, many of us know that homophobia, stigmatizing attitudes towards drug use are at the base of HIV stigma. And then in addition, I just wanted to, it's a point for the final speaker really, to urge that when we describe the manifestations of stigma, that we not forget violence and indeed murder and a reminder that openly HIV positive activists in places as diverse as South Africa, China, Mexico, are murdered for being openly positive, paying the highest price of all for stigma.
Okay, thank you. Microphone two again.
My name is Catherine Dodds, and I work with Sigma Research in the UK, and my point follows on directly from Susie's. I just had a question, possibly for Mary, actually, and as well as Laura and Charles. What practical examples have you seen where governments recognize that addressing stigma is not about just funding poster campaigns, but actually addressing the inequalities that Susie was talking about? For instance, in the UK, our Department of Health's draft action plan of stigma and discrimination, which is meant to be an action plan, has no actions that address law and policy. And like Mandeep said, that makes me very embarrassed to live in the UK. The Department of Health's view is that they can't tell other government departments what to do. So have you got any practical examples of how that kind of internal situation has been addressed successfully?
Good. Very good question. Do you want to jump in there? Okay.
A couple of points. I think
countries that have enacted positive legislation, model legislation around HIV, are a good example of countries that are making a commitment to addressing stigma and discrimination. However, that said, if legislation and changes in law and policy and action plans are not combined with community-level education, education of policymakers, and real access to justice and legal services, it falls short of a response. So I think it doesn't go far enough. I want to say two other quick things. One about the stigmatization of healthcare workers. I've done quite a bit of work in Zambia and talked lots to healthcare workers who are terrified to get access to treatment, and they're giving out treatment. They know they need it, but they refuse to get it because they're afraid. I think that's an important thing to remember. The other thing is the re-stigmatization of tuberculosis because of HIV, and that's another dimension which I think needs further exploration and challenges around addressing TB and HIV in an integrated manner. If we're re-stigmatizing TB in our scaling up of HIV services, it's also something we need to look into.
Thank you. I'm feeling the challenge from the chair, but I'm really going to get as many things in as possible, and they tell us we have to stop. Microphone three.
Yeah, my name is Sarah Rutstein. I'm from Duke University in North Carolina. My question is about when you're measuring stigma, even in populations where the knowledge level might be relatively high about means of transmission and that sort of thing, how do you address the issue of respondents trying to give the right or the correct answer in an attempt to try and please whoever's conducting the survey, and therefore not really getting an accurate portrayal of what the stigma issue might be in that population? Thank you.
Laura, do you want to jump in on that one?
I think you're talking about desirability bias. I'm sorry, there's an echo in the mic, so it's a bit hard for us to hear you. But I think, you know, Charles put up the slide that where you ask the questions both of the individual and then how they perceive that the community would respond is one way to get around that. And as you saw in that slide, there's a huge difference in the response there. We don't have a way of knowing whether that's social desirability bias or whether that is really a difference between actual stigma and perceived stigma, the perception of what's out there. I would argue that the perception of stigma is what really counts because that's what keeps people from addressing services. So it's very important to measure what people think is occurring in the community.
Okay, Mike one.
My name is Khalid Almila. I'm from South Africa. In South Africa, many studies are showing quite low levels of stigmatizing attitudes in the general population, but very high levels of perceived stigma and internalized stigma amongst people living with HIV. So in that context, truly if activists are consistently highlighting high levels of stigma in the general population, this is actually contributing to increased perceptions of high levels of stigma from the perspective of people living with HIV and actually contributing to the problem.
Okay, thank you. Mike, two.
Hi, my name is Deepa Rao. I'm from Northwestern University in Chicago in the United States. And my question is for Drs. Niblade and Katende. I wonder if you could speak more to how women experience stigma differentially. And my question is, if they do experience stigma differentially, how do we measure it and intervene in a universal way if, in fact, it is different?
Okay, quick answer.
Sorry, we're having a really hard time because of the echo.
Okay.
So you're asking how can we have universal measures, differential measures, if it's experienced differentially?
Right.
I think what we did when we were trying to look at sort of developing indexes was actually in which we were looking at which items to keep. We looked specifically at whether there were differences in experiences by men and women. I think there's also an issue of age, perhaps there that we weren't able to look at because of our sample sizes. But in those measures that in the report where we present, you know, we started with 17 measures, which ones we remained with, we looked specifically and made sure that items that men or women were experiencing substantially in different ways, those were kept in so that you had those, so you had an average. I think, you know, the basic also that you just have to disaggregate all your data by the experience of different groups. And I think also the point about you know, needing measures of homophobia and measures around stigma around drug use. I think this is one of our big challenges, is actually the layering of stigma. And we're actually doing work in Vietnam right now where drug use is sort of the underlying stigma in a big way. And so we're trying to tease that apart, but we still have a long ways to go on that.
Thank you. Mike Tree.
Thank you. My name is Jean-Thomas Nubusi. I work for Handicap International based in Kenya. During the whole session, you mentioned so many times vulnerable group, but I didn't heard about people living with HIV. People living with disability.
Yeah. And I'm going to actually stomp you there and say, quite honestly, if you hadn't done that, I was going to do it before the end. I promise you. Because it came up yesterday and something I was at as well. And you've made your point, honestly. You're right.
Okay.
So I'm going to go to mic one now because we have to get as much in, but you're absolutely right. Well done. Okay. One.
Ron Strauss from the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill in the U.S. And this is for Glenda Gray. Clearly we're all very concerned about the experience with healthcare workers that are stigmatizing. And I'm wondering if there couldn't be some discussion about the use of health professions education, medical school, dental school, nursing school, as a vehicle to respond to attitudes and to relinquish people who have stigmatizing orientations to rethink who they are and what their values are. Are there any exemplars? Are there examples of that happening?
The training of nurses and doctors is around HIV/AIDS is abysmal, and the issues around looking at stigma has not occurred, and it is an interesting thing. I think that we need to look at the levels of stigma and start working and how to address them, and it's quite multifactorial in South Africa. It's the lack of the low morale of staff, the lack of political leadership, the lack of ongoing support and training, the scarce human resources. So it's a multitude of factors. But our medical schools and our nursing colleges have not identified HIV/AIDS as an important part of training, and that's the core problem.
Can I just add to that? I think medical school is too late, and it was borne out in some of the consultations around universal access, where in countries where homophobia exists so strongly, where HIV activists have been killed, those are the countries that are suggesting that actually we need to start much earlier in school with specific education, not just on HIV, but on gender and sexuality and sexual orientation, that it has to start when people are much younger, because medical school is just far too late.
I'm Robert Plitzman from Columbia University in New York. Thank you for an excellent panel. I have a little sense of deja vu since a lot of these issues came up in the United States in the mid and late 80s and early 90s, and there was quite a bit of work done on it then by Greg Herrick, Scott Burris, et cetera, that might help inform some of these efforts. Just two quick things. One to follow up on the last question is that it turned out in the U.S., I think, that professional organizations did a lot of important work. In other words, the AMA and other groups and state medical associations came down quite hard on doctors, particularly surgeons, for instance, that refused to treat people with HIV. And I think that's set to the degree that professional organizations and professionalism as a concept can be mobilized, I think it would be great. And secondly, some work that I and others did found that if you ask people, have you felt stigma, they'll say no. They really don't. Stigma is our term. I think it's very important to keep in mind, those of us who've been trained in social science to some degree. And patients don't think of stigma as a concept, but if you ask them, they'll tell you about times that they've been denied services or that they weren't treated the way they should. So in terms of methodologically going forward, I think it's important to keep in mind. Thank you.
Very good point. And we're actually getting very good points and very good questions. And we have, in fact, by some method, negotiated another 5 minutes. So I hope to get to most of you. And if necessary, I'll get quick answers if I can. But Mike 3 again.
Okay. Thank you again. I was saying nobody mentioned about people with disability just because we think that they are not eligible for sex. They are not eligible for sex, and therefore they cannot be a vulnerable group for HIV/AIDS. Can we, please, from now, get rid of that thinking? Yeah. WHO estimates that people with disability count for almost 10% for any given population. Yeah. How can we fight efficiently the stigma? how can we achieve universal access to care, putting aside 10% of all the population? Yeah.
Could I make a suggestion, because your points are absolutely right. Could I suggest to our panel that when you talk about vulnerable groups in the future, you do actually specifically refer to those with disabilities, because the point is absolutely right. Okay, thanks.
Well, my name is David Matovu, working with the AIDS support organization in Uganda. My concern or question is, can we include children as a special group in those people who are being discriminated against as infected, affected, or orphans? I think we need to have a special group of those special people to be considered when we talk about discrimination.
Very good
stigma.
Point. I'll ask Laura to respond briefly.
That's a very good point. I just want to point out that tomorrow afternoon, I think it's the, if I read the program right, at the last session of the day, there is actually a session on stigma and discrimination in children tomorrow. So it's great to see that the conference has put a focus on that.
So
I just want to answer the question about the checklist that that was first asked. And there's a very interesting tool that's been put out by Horizons and Population Council in India called PLHA-friendly checklist about how to improve the quality of services so that they're destigmatizing and more friendly. And there are many, many such tools out there. And I think, you know, while we call for evidence and research and the development of new tools, I'd like to echo some of the points that have been made about using existing evidence and tools that are out there to scale up. We're only 3.5 years or 4 years away from universal access. I wouldn't invest too much more in new research. I'd get out there and work with what we have.
Good. Thank
very
you.
Short, please.
Yeah, in fairness to the organizers, I'm going to take one more from each mic, and then
we
just have to leave it. So, yes, two.
My name is Elena Vieta from Argentina, and I'm here for AIDS Care Watch campaign, Health and Development Network. I'm really happy to see Anwar and to see Latin America, which is being really forgotten for many years. And as a matter of fact, since Pan American Health Organization had a multi-center study on stigma in the healthcare setting, then afterwards nothing was done with it and with the results. When we have stigma and discrimination in all their healthcare settings in Latin America throughout it. So, gracias, Anwar. And
very briefly.
The question is, the toolkit, is it available online, first? And second, is it available in Spanish? Please, the second language spoken in the world. Thank you.
I think the answer is yes, but Laura?
Yeah, we have been struggling, and I think this goes to your point about Latin America being forgotten. I will say right now, we've been struggling to find funding to put the toolkit in Spanish, and that makes your point completely.
Okay, you might even get a volunteer somewhere out of here. Yes, Mike Treat.
Hello, thank you. My name is Liz Frost-Yocum from the BBC World Service Trust. I'd like to thank all the presenters for a very good session, very challenging and very heartening as well. I support and agree with all the points that have been made about the need for accurate and positive portrayal of HIV-positive people living with AIDS in the media. But I'd like to also express a concern specifically about unintended effects and perhaps stigmatizing effects indirectly communicated by prevention campaigns and other campaigns. And so I was going to ask a question, but now I'd just like to pose the comment that I believe these materials are not just going to be valuable for anti-stigma work. I would just encourage anybody doing education to consider these issues at all stages of their education work, not just when it comes time to do anti-stigma work. Mm. Thank you.
And also, maybe since you're speaking from the context of media, a lot of what we've been talking about is also something that the media needs to be very much on top of.
Yes.
Yeah. And Mike, one?
Yes. Yeah. My name is Ami Bishop from PATH. And I just wanted, first of all, thank Mandeep for mentioning the TB and HIV connection. That was something I was going to raise, and now I don't have to, but it's very important. The main point I would like to make is just quickly that while I share Laura's observation and belief that the issues of stigma are universal, as someone who works predominantly in Eastern Europe, I notice a complete and total absence of the mention of that region. And I think that in some ways that region is probably a decade or two behind many of the other regions of the world and dealing with these issues, and it has to do with all sorts of structural issues, political issues, as well as the topics at hand. So since you put out a call for interested people to, or interested groups that might want to help pilot test or evaluate some of your tools, I'm just making an offer that our program in Ukraine would be more than welcome to, more than happy to collaborate with you. So
thank you for a very good point and for a very good offer. I think you'll probably find it's going to be taken up. If anybody wants to make one last comment from the panel, because I haven't really allowed, but we really have to stop then. Yep.
My last comment is to go back to my plea at the end of my presentation. For everybody who is in a country where a universal access plan is meant to be made by the end of 2006, get in touch with your UNAIDS office. They're meant to be supporting countries to develop their universal access plans, and that these plans must include adequate, concrete stigma reduction interventions and a budget to go with it. Otherwise, we're not going to get where we need to go.
Okay, and I think I'll have to take that actually as the last point. It's a very good strategy point. I have to thank an excellent panel. I learned a lot from what the presentations, and a very good listening audience. And I'm sorry we couldn't take all the questions and very good comments that were made. Come up afterwards if you've got other points. Thank you. No, it's excellent. It's very good. Hi.